You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, February 11, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Dave Zirin of The Nation on Sochi. Michael Sam and a move to unionize some players in college basketball. Also on the program today, Chris Christie's administration still in increasingly hot water. Is Scott Walker next? Also, a big union fight in Tennessee. The fight not between the union and management, but the union and management and right-wingers who don't want a union in the South. A mandate for businesses pushed further back, and Obamacare meaning absolutely virtually nothing. But more importantly, in Arkansas, they may have decided not to take that federal funds from Medicare, Medicaid after all, denying hundreds of thousands of people health insurance. The Republicans, oh, and we will also talk about that huge moral, I guess not Monday, march on Saturday. 80 to 100,000 people. In the biggest march in the South since the civil rights era. And this just breaking. Apparently, the Republicans, as you know, were attempting to figure out a way they could pretend that they were holding up the debt ceiling vote and agree upon what they were going to ask for ransom. Nobody was really taking them seriously, and apparently not even the Republicans were taking themselves seriously. At one point, they were talking about trying to replace the sequester on the military by reviving military pensions, tying it to the debt ceiling, finding savings other places. Meanwhile, the Senate had already passed a reinstatement of those of that that vet pension, 94-0. So they had nothing to really vote on, and it was just announced moments ago that John Boehner, facing opposition from his own party on his debt ceiling proposal, will bring legislation to a vote tomorrow to raise the government's debt ceiling with no strings attached. The Republicans will bring as many votes as necessary to pass this with a majority of Democratic votes, therefore breaking the non-existent Hastert rule and showing that John Boehner, again, he will maintain his position as majority leader, or House Speaker, I should say. But to do so just by basically doing nothing. He's just going to take everybody out and buy him a drink. Meanwhile, today, ladies and gentlemen, is What's the name of the website again?
Today We Fight Back.
Today
the
We Fight
Back. The Day We Fight Back.
The Day We Fight Back.org. It is a an action being taken by a lot of organizations, including the EFF. It will basically, you can either dial a number, 202-552-0505, or go to thedaywefightback.org. We got a link at Majority FM. You click to enter your phone number and have Twilio, I guess. I'm not sure what that is, but some service that will connect you. You want to leave a message for your representatives to support the USA Freedom Act, which is essentially will roll back a lot of the surveillance powers by the NSA. Oppose the FISA Improvements Act, which is a whitewash bill, which will actually increase surveillance power. Protect people around the globe and protect encryption standards. Thedaywefightback.org. Check it out. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Dave Zirin. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome Dave Zirin. He is the Nation Magazine sports editor, author of Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down, and author of the forthcoming Brazil's Dance with the Devil about the World Cup. Welcome to the program, Dave.
Great to be here, Sam. The only problem is I have no idea what we're going to talk about for the next 20 minutes.
Oh, well, I want to talk about Sochi. I want to talk about Michael Sam, and I want to talk about these stories of unionization that are sort of starting to bubble up in college sports.
Yeah, I was being sarcastic. I mean, it's actually, I'm overwhelmed with the amount of sports politics stories coming down the pike these days.
That was the first thing I was going to say to you. It's like, it has been unbelievable. You know, we have talked in the past, and one of the things that I love about your writing is that it reveals to people the sort of inherent politics that are taking place in sports that I think people don't first recognize. And over the past like month, it has been the amount of politics in sports, and you know, maybe a little longer, has been so explicit, ranging from both social issues and economic issues, that it's been stunning. And I think, you know, frankly, when I see a tweet about, you know, John Elway complaining about handouts and somebody coming back with, why doesn't somebody ask him about the subsidies, you know, his football stadium has gotten, I really think to a large extent that is because of the writing that you've been doing over the years, because I don't see anybody else out there making those connections. But what's going on? Is there something in the water or what?
Yeah, no, I think we've hit a perfect storm on a whole bunch of issues. And with social media, which of course allows for a kind of direct backtalk of us lonely peons to the people on high in the sports establishment, that's created even more of a kind of explicit dialogue. But you're talking about a lot of different issues that have come together all at once. And I would argue that it all spins around the Sochi Olympics, because one of the things about the Sochi Games, because Russia is right now at loggerheads with the United States for all sorts of reasons, it's opened up a lot of official criticism about Russia, about Putin, but also about issues like homophobia in the Olympics. And once you start talking about that, then it becomes a discussion that becomes much more difficult for kind of the media powers that be to control. It's a much more difficult discussion to control. So it's like, okay, well, if we're going to talk about homophobia in the Olympics, let's talk about homophobia in U.S. sports right here. If we're going to talk about corporate cronyism and corruption in the $50 billion Olympics, let's talk about all the cronyism and corruption that took place around the Super Bowl in New York and New Jersey last month. If we're going to talk, I mean, so many issues. If we're going to talk about amateurism and the idea of what happens to these athletes, how do they subsist when they're not at the Olympics themselves, then let's talk about amateurism with regards to the NCAA. So I think it's been the specter of Sochi that's allowed for all kinds of local issues here in the U.S. to just come exploding to the surface.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, and it's interesting, too, because, I mean, well, I'm put Sochi in context first. Obviously, gay rights is a big issue because of laws that have been passed in Russia over the past couple of years. And we've spoken about that, in terms of Russian society. But do you think part of that, and I want to talk about it in terms of what's happening in Sochi, but do you think part of it is also that Sochi isn't necessarily more corrupt in those other areas than past Olympics have been, or is it also because of the nature of U.S.-Russian relations that there's more comfortability? In fact, there's almost more of a compulsion to talk about, because Russia's, you know, such a we have such a history of sort of demonizing, I guess, the Soviet Union and now Russia. I mean, what accounts for that?
Yeah, it's a comfortable coat, to be sure. I think the tough thing that listeners need to grapple with, Sam, is that the answer is yes to all those questions.
Right.
Yes, because there's conflict with Russia, it opens space for more discussion, and Russia's easy to demonize because it's something that the United States has done well for decades. That's a yes right there. Yes, it's true that every Olympics has corruption. Every Olympics has kind of the crony capitalism. Every Olympics has the oppression of the most vulnerable people in society. That's true as well. But it's also true that, yes, that this Olympics is particularly bad. This Olympics is worse than all the others. They're all bad. This is worse. And it's not worse because it's covered with, you know, magical evil Russia sprinkles or something like that. This is not difficult to figure out. It's worse because Vladimir Putin went to the International Olympic Committee and he didn't say, I want to hold the Winter Games in Moscow, or I want to hold the Winter Games in somewhere where there is snow in Russia. He said, I want to hold the Winter Games in a subtropical climate for the purposes of remaking an entire region. And that's really the original sin of all of this, of everything that we can talk about in terms of injustice in the Sochi Games, is that its starting point was about Vladimir Putin trying to use the Olympics with the IOC's full enabling as a kind of Trojan horse to go into the Caucasus, where there's been, of course, war for 20 years at the cost of several hundred thousand lives, and remake the region. And that remaking of the region lent itself to massive construction projects where there was all kind of corruption. That remaking of the region also led for the need, frankly, to scapegoat people and to get attention away from the fact that this incredible amount of resources were going into this one small part of what is a massive country that has, you know, as they keep telling us on NBC, 9 time zones, all this intensive capital development in a very small part of the country. And so what do you do then? Well, you push forward a law that scapegoats LGBT people, classic political maneuver. So all of these things playing together simultaneously, and the original sin of it really is these kinds of intra-imperial aspirations of Putin to remake this region of Russia.
And Sochi is the site or the date of a genocide of of people of that area. Is that right? From about 100?
I'm going to be actually posting an article about this in the next day. They're called the Circassian people. 9 out of 10 Circassians do not live in their ancestral home, which is the Sochi area. Sochi is actually a Circassian word that means between mountain and sea. And this is, as you said, the 150th anniversary of what's known as the Circassian genocide. That was Tsar Nicholas II just going in there and undergoing a mass slaughter of the Circassian population. And the Circassian population has been incredibly energized around trying to say, hey, wait a minute, these Sochi games cannot happen without any mention of the fact that we once lived there and that we do actually exist. And they started an organization called No Sochi 2014. People can find them on Twitter. And they've been going. I've been seeing these folks for a while because they've been going to the last several Olympics, dating back to Vancouver in 2010, and just trying to make connections with local activists, saying like, hey, this is happening in Sochi. Get this on your radar screen because we really want to raise the mantle of the Circassian people.
And so what happens to Sochi after, I mean, you know, a couple of weeks go by, they start to wind down. I mean, what happens? Does this become a just sort of a some type of, I don't know, luxury playground
Potemkin
for Russia?
Village? No.
I mean, what?
It becomes Potemkin Village. It becomes like, do you remember that last scene in Blazing Saddles where the entire Western town just falls down because it's fake? I mean, this is what happens with all Olympics, is that they are building, structures that have no use value unless you're holding a Winter Olympics. Now, granted, some of these structures can have more of a use value if, say, you're building them in a winter climate, because then it can be a kind of, you know, playground for the wealthy or even, you know, the not so wealthy, you know, people who go skiing, people who go ice skating, like a place people can visit. But let's remember, this is a subtropical climate. They have been keeping snow in these massive freezers for months for the purposes of creating these winter games. They're not going to be doing that once the Olympics are done. So what is a skiing mountain without snow? You know, what does that even mean? I mean, what do you even call that? So there's not going to be a lot of there. There's just going to be billions of dollars in waste. And what is particularly, I think, nerve-wracking about it for me is what is going to happen to the LGBT movement once the cameras have gone home, once everybody's gone home, once people are faced with the economic catastrophe of this, and what happens if then Putin sets his sights and says, you know why these Olympics didn't make back their money? The gays.
Right. And on some level, that's always that's the safety valve for them too, right? I mean,
yes.
We create this controversy, and then we can scapegoat them. You know, from the IOC's, from their perspective, like, you know, when Putin comes in and says, you know, this is my plan to sort of create this, to spend these billions of dollars to, you know, pay off all these people and to create this sort of unsustainable new city, essentially, what are they thinking? I mean, do they not contemplate any of these issues?
No, the IOC is thinking hell to the yeah, because for the IOC, it's all about bigger is better. John Carlos, the famous 1968 Olympian, he has this line where he always says, you know why they only have the Olympics every 4 years? It's because it takes them 4 years to count the money. I mean, we don't know exactly where this money goes or how it's spent, but the bigger the Olympics, the bigger the project. That means the bigger the corporate infrastructure, the bigger the corporate branding. I mean, corporations love the Olympics because it allows them to do what I call corporate sin washing, because there are real studies that show that if a corporation attaches itself to the Olympics, the public tends to look much more favorably on that corporation. So if you're McDonald's, if you're Dow Chemical, if you're British Petroleum, you want to be on every single athlete's uniform or as many as possible. You want to be all over the place. And the IOC knows that the bigger the project, the more corporate money it can bring in because of the nature of the public and private partnerships that go with countries. It's basically a 50-50 split, and then cost overruns are put on the state. So you want that initial 50-50 split to be as big as possible so you can lure as many corporations as possible.
I mean, in some respects, I mean, this is and I guess this sort of brings us back to where we started, is that the Olympics are sort of the perfect metaphor for what is problematic about sports, because there's not going to be any pushback to just the whole concept of creating this unsustainable subsidized in, on the backs of you know, I guess those in Russia, but you know, because the only way that you would hear about it would be through the media, but of course the media is just doing too well too, right? NBC is not going to say, now we're going to spend an hour on a documentary about just how bad all this is.
No, instead, oddly, NBC did a long segment on Mary Carrillo going up to Siberia, which is one of the coldest regions in the world, to look at the like the ice sculptures of Siberia, which would sort of be like, you know, if you were doing the Olympics in Atlanta and you said, and now let's see what's happening in Toronto. I mean, it makes no real conceivable sense. But, you know, they're looking for these kinds of gauzy, soft stories. Because a lot of people do watch there's a tradition of people who do watch the Olympics who aren't sports fans, and they like learning about other countries and sitting around the TV, and that's all fine and good, but where is the line between telling the story of a country and then basically propagandizing for a country? And I'll say the same thing about the United States. When the United States had the 96 Olympics in Atlanta, there was this entire, I don't know if you remember this, but remember Bill Clinton was there, and there was all this thematic bombast about the New South, 96, Atlanta, the city that's too busy to hate, and all the rest of it. And meanwhile, while they're doing, like, literally tributes to Dr. King as part of the Olympic opening ceremonies, African Americans are being thrown out of their homes and having their public housing torn to the ground to make way for Olympic facilities. The joke in Atlanta was that the prison was the only thing that was built on time and under budget. The new prison that was built. So right. It's like these things are always part of how Olympics are broadcast. And yeah, it would be very nice to see a more transparent kind of coverage.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting too. I mean, you know, getting to that point of branding, you had a piece about the Super Bowl and the sort of the weird relationship between the military, the Super Bowl, and in this case, it was Budweiser. And that struck me, too, just how just utterly sort of bizarre that the way that sports are used to sort of inject a certain type of propaganda and certain political messages in a way that is so subtle that we don't even recognize it anymore.
And that one in particular, though, I almost felt like they took it a bridge too far. Because to go from, like, you have a very real-life soldier who gets sent home not really knowing why, just knowing that it has to do with the U.S. Army's propaganda division, literally, as I believe that's what they're called, like the media propaganda division. And he gets greeted by Budweiser at the airport along with his wife, gets an impromptu parade where he has to ride on the Budweiser wagon. And then all the real emotion is captured. He sees his mom. They hug. It's all real emotion. And then the next shot, he's in the stands at the Super Bowl drinking a Budweiser. And it almost makes your head spin. It's like the triple Lindy placement. I think if we were more aware, and if, frankly, if the NFL was more self-aware, they wouldn't be doing things like that. You know, we're also approaching the 10-year anniversary of the death of Pat Tillman.
Right.
You don't hear much about that.
Yeah, and you, I think you in that piece you spoke to his mom.
I spoke to Pat's mom, Mary, one of the greatest people I've ever had the privilege to meet. And Mary, you know, is somebody who, she's had multiple kids who've gone into the military, you know, and she chooses her words carefully, and she takes it very seriously, and she thinks that the idea of selling a false view of what military life actually is through sports is immoral. And how can anybody who's ever actually been or been connected to the military argue with that?
I want to turn to just the story of Michael Sam because it's a really big deal. And you had a quote I guess it was an interview you did with Josh Idelson when you were talking about John Carlos, and we should say that you co-authored his memoir, you said, I guess basically quoting him, the athletes have minds, not only bodies, and expecting athletes to be just instruments of physical excellence, yet not have an opinion in their heads about the ways in which their physical excellence has been used politically is to deny them their humanity. And this, you know, this is where sort of we begin to contextualize athletics and sports in the same way that we contextualize people's own labor, and the idea that, you know, you work somewhere, you shouldn't have an opinion about it is just absurd. And
I really have to steer people, Sam, to another Sam, but albeit a woman named Samantha Retrosi, who is a 2006 Olympian who wrote a piece that's up on The Nation. It's called Why the Olympics Are Like the Hunger Games. And that's exactly what Samantha walks people through, is the ways in which Olympians really are workers and the ways in which their minds are basically colonized by the political realities in which they step into and by the ways in which they have to basically be salespeople for the various products that are underwriting their very training that over the course of years, and they get training in how to do that. And she keeps going to this analysis, and I think it's a very apt analysis about understanding Olympians as workers, understanding trainers as middle managers, and understanding a whole system of discipline that's very vertically organized.
You know, it's interesting because I think there's an inclination amongst people to be just like, can't we have sports just sort of devoid of these things? I mean, why does my enjoyment of this sort of form of escapism have to be tainted by the fact, I mean, I guess they're not saying it explicitly, but really what they're saying, tainted by the fact that we're talking about human beings.
And you're absolutely right. Chuck Klosterman, the author, he may or may not have been making a reference to me on a recent interview. People on Twitter were telling me he was, where he's basically said, some people exist only to be outraged. They don't enjoy sports. And if I could, I don't even know if Chuck was talking about me or not, but I'd love the opportunity to kick that idea in the ass, because basically it's like I love sports, and I've grown up loving sports, and I grew up going to games and sneaking into games and playing games, and I'm actually, if I'm outraged by anything, I'm outraged by the fact that we can't just watch them a la carte, and we can't just enjoy them for what they are, that experience has been so scarred by everything from corporatism to homophobia, racism. I mean, I'm a big football fan, and I live in a town where people root for a team that's named after a racial slur.
Right.
It's like, so then what's your choice? You gotta be like, gee, don't be outraged, just watch and enjoy. And it's like, okay, well, you know, I almost quoted Woody Allen. I'm not going to do that, but for reasons that are probably obvious. But basically, it's like you can just smile and watch the game, but at some point you get old, and at some point you die. At some point you have to actually, you know, make an effort and think about the fact that you live in this world and you have a responsibility to other people around you.
You know, it's interesting because I think, you know, there seems to be almost a natural life cycle to these type of things where, you know, where we are still in many respects, there's two different things going on. On one hand, we are still sort of we are still getting the ripple effects of the emancipation, the social emancipation that took place, at least in terms of legislation in the 60s and in the 70s, in terms of women's rights, in terms of African Americans, in terms of minorities, in terms of gender identification, sexual identification, and we're also on some level, you know, sort of taking these principles of labor too and applying them to sports. And it seems like it throughout, you know, first it was the workplace. Oh, really? Can't we just go into work and, you know, I don't know, you know, ogle my secretary. Why does that have to be ruined now? And yeah. it just seems like sports is one of the last sort of frontiers where that's being addressed. You know, when Michael said, well, tell the story of Michael Sam to people who haven't heard it. The most shocking thing to me about the whole thing has been the executives, the anonymous executives. But
I think there's a tie of two shocking things, and we'll talk about it. Michael Sam, he's a college All-American. He is the co-Southeastern Conference Defensive Player of the Year, playing for a surprise Missouri team that had an amazing season. They went 12-2. Michael Sam on Sunday, as he put it, owns his own truth. He came out of the closet, but as Wade Davis of the organization You Can Play said, it's less that he came out of the closet and more that he let other people in. And he, you know, he, by all intents and purposes, should be drafted to play in the National Football League. Now, the two shocking things. To me, the first shocking thing was hearing that he told his teammates back in August. That's like 100 guys. Told them all. He said, I'm gay. I'm proud. You're my family. I want to tell you. And these 18 to 22-year-olds kept his secret the entire season. They respected his right to come out on his own terms. I mean, that's amazing. If you think about it, especially these days where 18 to 22-year-olds are putting everything out on social media. And yet, you know, like, what I went to the bathroom. Oh, I'm going to tweet it. You know, it's like people, like the self-discipline that they showed and the love of their teammate that they showed is amazing. And, of course, the fact that they went through the whole season and not only survived having Michael Sam in the locker room but thrived and voted him MVP gives lie to that bugaboo about, oh, you can't have gay people because the locker room will somehow implode with gayness. So,
well, how do you know that that team wouldn't have gone 14-0 if he hadn't come out as gay?
Because they're Missouri. that doesn't happen. But the second point, I would say, though, to speak what you were saying, Sam, is just the shock at, like, literally, like, after an hour of learning. Michael Sam, oh, my gosh, he's gay. Oh, he's going to play in the NFL. Oh, this is amazing. It's a bold new world. And then also people in immediate reaction, oh, it's not even a big deal. You liberals are making too big a deal out of it. No one cares if anyone's gay anymore. You know, just get off your soapbox, blah, blah, blah. Then you get the article from Pete Thamel in Sports Illustrated, which has a ton of anonymous blind quotes from NFL general managers, basically saying that he may even have cost himself being drafted because of coming out. And just a rack of homophobic comments, from that having a gay player will, quote, change chemical balance of a locker room. There were statements like that. There were statements like, well, we may be ready in a decade or two. And the most cowardly part of all of the statements by these NFL, there was not one positive statement by one NFL executive in this entire article. And the most kind of depressing part about it, the most enraging part was that they all sort of put it on the players.
Right.
They didn't own their own bigotry. They didn't own their own homophobia. They were like, yeah, you know, we'd love to do it, but woo, these players, yeah, they'd eat them alive. It would be a disaster. You know, you couldn't have it with players. Even though Michael Sam is coming out of an experience in the Southeastern Conference, and just so people know, the Southeastern Conference, a lot of people say going from the SEC to some NFL teams is a demotion. Like, this is big-time college football. And so despite the fact that we have this living example from the Missouri season, no, it's still the locker room. They can't handle it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand, like, what is the I mean, these guys are just out-and-out bigots. I mean, because it seems to me it flies in the face of the empirical reality they have of this team doing so well, of the fact that 100 players had this guy's back and weren't going to, you know, we're going to let him dictate the terms in which he came out in a broader way, that he's voted MVP, that it clearly did not disturb the chemical balance of the locker room.
The chemical balance.
It's just, and you know, I mean, I would have thought that if you had asked me, all right, this is going to come out, what we're going to see is we're going to see some NFL players come out and say some, you know, some guys are a-holes. That's just the way it is. That's inevitable. What are you going to do? They're going to suck it up because they're going to have to deal with it. They're just, you know, they're dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm. That's life.
But I would have thought, I would have thought that the executives would have all been, at the very least, just from a PR standpoint, like, this is great. Good for him. He's a good kid. You know,
yeah.
And just the idea that they're sniping like that is, it's just almost like they don't even have the capacity to control themselves.
I think a lot of it, though, is like, I think that's a huge part of it, Sam. I think some of it also is cowardice. I mean, NFL general managers are profoundly risk averse because basically their job. Can I curse on your show, Sam? I don't even know if I can or not.
Yeah, sure.
I probably can't.
Go ahead.
Oh, their job is utterly unadulterated horseshit. It's a bullshit job being an NFL general manager. You know why? Because any player they pick, there's a one out of two chance they're going to suck anyway. I mean, the NFL draft is littered with can't misses who missed and littered with players who shouldn't have had a shot do great. I mean, the best quarterback in the NFL right now, arguably, is Russell Wilson. Just led his team to the Super Bowl. He was drafted in the third round after a punter. Every team passed on him multiple times, and he's right now the champ. So this is the nature of the NFL. So any effort that they can do to limit the possibility of something bad happening, they're going to try to do it, even if their definition of something bad, quote-unquote, is so retrograde, so backwards, so insanely antediluvian, they are going to do that. So it's like, well, there's a chance that having a gay player will disrupt the locker room. Therefore, why take that chance? Even though you could say, why take that chance on every single player they'll draft?
Right. In their mind, the owner's not going to come down the hall and say, why did you not draft that gay player? We need more gay players on our team, or I guess.
Yeah. Risk averse. Figure out a way to quantify the unquantifiable.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about what's happening from an economic standpoint in sports. I mean, over the past couple of weeks, we have cheerleaders for the L.A. Raiders or Oakland. Are they L.A. Raiders now? Still,
yes. Okay. Oh, they're Oakland. They're Oakland
Raiders. The Oakland Raiders come out and basically start to sue for wage theft. I couldn't believe mm-hmm. that the terms of their contract is unbelievable. They work 10 hours on, I guess, once a week on the teams. They don't get paid for practices. They get $125 bucks like for a 10-hour day. They don't get paid for any of the charitable appearances. It's unbelievable.
They can get fired, and they can get fired and treated like Hester Prynne if there's so much as seen talking to one of the players.
It's just stunning. And then let's also talk about what's going on in terms of unionizing college athletes, because this is fascinating. They are so unbelievably exploited. Tell us what's happening on that front.
Sure. You had just said history made at Northwestern University, where the team, led by their quarterback, Kane Coulter, submitted to the National Labor Relations Board almost 100% of the team signing on union cards. And they are trying to, and they're waiting for the NLRB ruling, and they want to be recognized as a union. Now, there are a ton of pitfalls going forward, but I really do view this as the first crack in the NCAA's cartel. This is really that first ripple in the water, and it's going to be fascinating to see where this goes from here, spreads, even how it doesn't spread and why it doesn't spread, because the sentiment that they're putting forward, which isn't even about money, even though they generate so many billions of dollars, college football players, it's about saying we want to make sure our health care is covered. We want to make sure our education is covered if we get hurt on the field. We want to make sure that there's some basic fairness in this relationship. And that, believe me, scares the holy hell out of the NCAA. And of the people at Northwestern, it scares them, the powers that be there, for a very different reason. Because if Northwestern recognizes this union, and Northwestern can recognize the union independent of the NCAA, not only do they risk getting kicked out of the NCAA, but also they run the risk of the graduate students and the work-study students and everybody on campus saying, where's my union?
Right. And so now, from the perspective of the National Labor Relations Board, can they find in favor of these guys because they're not getting paid? I mean,
of course they can, because the reason why they can is that currently they really are getting paid. It's just not discussed. Like, this is, gets very under-discussed, but say you're a college football player and you don't want to live in a dorm, you want to live off campus, then you can apply to get your housing money in cash and live off campus. Say you don't want to eat your meals in the school cafeteria, you can get money to get your meals off of campus. So you can, like, do all of these things that connote payment. And that's going to be their main argument, that there's money being exchanged all the time. It's just that there is a legal fiction called student athletics, which, by the way, was created by the NCAA in the 1950s, so they wouldn't have to pay the widow of a man named Ray Bannister who died on the field. They didn't want to have to pay her workers' comp. So they made up this legal fiction called student athletics and student athletes. That's where the word comes from. And so that's why it's hilarious when you look at the NCAA's response to this union effort. You got to look at the response. It's like it's literally a four-sentence response that uses the phrase student athlete five times. Like, it reminds you of the Joe Biden thing about Giuliani, where it's just a noun, a verb, and 9/11. It's just every sentence is a noun, a verb, and student-athlete, because student-athlete is kind of like their great legal bulwark against them being recognized as workers.
Now, what does it say that this that this came out of Northwestern as opposed to any other school?
It says that you had students there who were going to class. I mean, there are a couple of schools. They tend to be very elite colleges like Northwestern, like Stanford, like Notre Dame, where there are very few of these schools that expect to put on big-time football and expect the athletes to actually go to class. And there are not a lot of schools that operate in that way. And one of the genesis of this idea in and of itself was the fact that Kane Coulter and several of his teammates were taking a labor law class at Northwestern.
Hmm.
And they were hearing all the theories about labor law, and they said, wait a minute, why doesn't this apply to our situation? And that's the other part of this, which makes me so, like, I mean, I want to laugh or cry or at the NCAA, is that they talk, they blather, they bleat, they harangue us about student athletes, and here's the real thing.
Right.
Here are athletes who are going to class, they're thinking critically. How do I apply my knowledge I learn in this ivory tower to the real world? And they're getting slammed for it. I mean, that to me just exposes so clearly the NCAA is really just a system of indentured servitude.
What's going on the campus? I mean, are students rallying around these guys or what?
Well, the football season just ended, of course. My understanding is that everybody's buried in snow. But beyond the snow by which people are, I mean, my sister lives in Evanston, so I speak with some seriousness there. But the idea is that, yeah, of course it has support on campus. People are proud of the fact that their football team really was the first. The same way people at Missouri are proud of the fact that Michael Sam was the first. I mean, because I think when you're part of an environment that produces a trailblazer, you get that feeling of pride because you
right.
really do feel like, hey, I helped create the circumstances that made people feel like they could take this historic step.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. I hope people are following you on Twitter and checking out edgeofsports.com because I can't remember a time where we have had more of the politics of sports. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really been fascinating stuff. Dave, thank you so much for your time today.
No, my privilege. Thanks so much, Dan.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. I'm going to first remind you that it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member today at majority.fm. Pick up the app at majorityapp.com. If you buy crap on Amazon, the least you can do is buy it through our link. Go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the link, buy all your Amazon crap that you buy if you buy it from Amazon. I'm not saying you should, but if you do, buy it through our link. We get a kickback. You click on the link. You bookmark it. You always use that as your Amazon. Even if you're buying a book or whatever it is, it's still we get a little kickback. Every little bit helps. That way we can get, we're going to send Michael to a course on where he can learn to unplug things and plug them back in. All sorts of different, we're sending him to a learning annex. Also, folks, leave us a review on iTunes. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Just a little housekeeping. I'm sure I will mention this again this week, but next week will be public school vacation week, so I am off, and we will be having almost all new content next week. Some stuff from the Families USA healthcare conference, some stuff on healthcare, some stuff on broader issues. We're going to be talking to Lauren Coodley on her book on Upton Sinclair. We may have one or two other interviews for you. So you'll have mostly all new content next week. Maybe there'll be like a teaser Tuesday or something like that for you freebies. But just wanted to give you a heads up. Tomorrow on the program, Noam Schreiber will be here from the New Republic on the concept of socializing our law. We're going to take a break. We come back. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be a part of the program. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me at Majority FM. See you in a minute.
Hey.